And good morning. It is 8:08 on WCCO. I am Laura Oakes. I'm joined by another Laura in studio today. We have two Lauras and a Candace and an Al who just walked out. But the other Laura is the amazing Laura Irish Hansen from the University of Minnesota Extension. We're so happy to have you here in person, Laura. Thanks for coming down.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited. First time in the studio with you all. I usually am in my PJs at home.
Yeah, I know. Well, you could have worn your PJs. We pretty much dress like we just rolled out of bed, and that is perfectly fine at this hour. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what your background is and what you do at the U.
Yeah, well, I have like a 20-minute background story, but I probably won't do that this morning.
Okay.
I got into horticulture because of my parents. So my parents were avid gardeners. I grew up in a suburb of Chicago and in a cookie-cutter neighborhood. So everyone in the 90s, you know, boxwood, little bubble gums, lava rock, and whiskey barrels. That was it. Mm-hmm. Not my parents. My dad was big into edibles. My mom had a beautiful ornamental garden in the front that people would stop and see. And I actually got into natural areas, worked for the Youth Conservation Corps for a few summers, and then a long, winding road, I ended up in horticulture at Iowa State for my undergrad, and I fell in love, and then I rolled right into a master's working on a food security project that was going on in Iowa. And the whole time I was at Iowa State, I was teaching the advanced plant propagation course, and Minnesota needed someone to come and teach plant propagation.
Okay.
So I landed in Minnesota in 2018 to teach plant propagation on the St. Paul campus. And I did that for about 6 years. And then I joined Extension 2.5 years ago because I really fell in love with Minnesota. My husband and I both did. We never want to leave. And I wanted to help more Minnesotans be successful with their gardens.
So, and let's explain to folks what the Extension is. It's a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
What is it? What does the Extension provide?
Yeah, so Extension is actually a part of all land grants across the U.S. And so Extension has been around for over 100 years. And it originally began as kind of a helping people be successful with their own home gardens, kind of home ec, that kind of thing. I should go back. Most people, if you've heard of 4-H, 4-H is part of Extension.
Okay.
Most people know Extension through 4-H.
Gotcha.
Maybe they don't know 4-H is part of Extension, though. But it's morphed a lot since, you know, the early 1900s. And so at least for us in horticulture, our job is to just help people be successful with their gardens and show benefit and value to Minnesotans, right? And be able to either do cost savings, environmental work, all these fun things. And there's so many great programs beyond plants.
Yeah. Well, we are happy to have you and all of the other wonderful Extension experts. You guys kind of rotate on these Saturdays, and it is kind of like having your own personal gardener, horticulture expert to help with our problems and with our questions. And we are taking your problems and questions this morning, too, for Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension. You know the number, 651-461-9226. We'd love to line up a few phone calls. Laura, we do have a few texts on the line as well, so I'm going to get to those right away because we do have a break coming up shortly. All right, first texter, we have a newly planted balsam fir. The new growth on the ends of the branches is curling down. No aphids, and the soil is kept watered. What could be the problem?
Ooh, I would love to see a photo. That would really help me just to see if it's problematic or if it's just a little stressed out from the heat that we've been getting. So if you've kept it pretty well watered, I'm really curious how deep you planted that tree. So one of the biggest things that we see that can be problematic, our trees are buried way too deep. We want to make sure that we do not cover that root flare. So if you do buy a potted tree or shrub, for that matter, sometimes they're actually potted too deep in the original pot. So even just following the same soil level may be a little too deep. And that can kind of stress those plants out.
That's good to know. Yeah. I would not have known that.
Yeah. And don't mulch up to the stem.
Yes.
Pull the mulch away about 3 inches. That can also be helpful. So if it is planted at the correct depth, then that's not the issue. You've been watering it. It's been mulched. My hunch is that it is just stressed out from the heat.
Yeah.
But if you want to send photos, you can to Ask a Master Gardener, and that's on our Extension website. So extension.umn.edu. and you can send some nice photos in, and we have a wonderful amount of master gardeners who can help you with that.
For sure. Great. Thank you. Candace, looks like we have a caller on the line.
Yes, Mary Lou from Crystal.
Go ahead, Mary Lou. What's your question for Laura?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I didn't expect to get on so quick.
Yep.
I really miss Danny, but Laura, it's really fun to have you on, too.
Thank you
anyway,
very much.
Anyway, my question is, can I cut, I have about a six-year-old redbud tree. Can I cut the branches a third to kind of round it up?
Yeah. So, Cercis canadensis, that's the scientific name, the redbuds, that is my favorite small tree. I have some in my front yard, and I'm assuming the way you've described it, you want it to be more of a tree form. So naturally, most of those redbuds actually want to have multiple stems come up and have more kind of a wild, like, vase shape, just for you to know. So you might actually see some more stems coming up from the bottom if you go to prune it. But yes, you can actually limit up so you can remove some of those lower branches. I'd recommend waiting until the winter while the plant is dormant. There aren't too many disease issues that we see that will be spread in the summer, but just to avoid it and be cautious, I would wait to do that pruning until, maybe January or February.
Good. How much Latin did you have to learn to know the real names of these plants, Laura?
So in one of my undergrad classes, it was my woody plant ID class, when we had the exams, if we stammered during pronunciation, we would lose points.
Oh, so, come on.
But it really, really helped me learn how to pronounce the scientific names.
Talk about pressure.
Yeah. But, it was good. It was good for me in the end.
That's good. That's a lot to know. We are talking with Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension on Smart Gardens this morning. If you have a gardening or yard question for Laura, give us a call, give us a text. The number is the same, 651-461-9226. And Laura, when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you about Japanese knotweed. That's coming up on CCO. It's 8:19 on WCCO. You're listening to Smart Gardens on WCCO Radio. And we are joined in studio by Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension, taking your calls and questions. They are rolling in, people. Thank you so much for participating this morning. If you have a question for Laura about your garden, your flowers, your plants, your vegetables, your lawn, 651-461-9226 is the number. Couple of callers on the line. Candace, who do we have?
Okay, first we have Dan from Blaine.
Go ahead, Dan. What's your question for Laura?
Hi, Laura. My name is Dan. Hey, I got a magnolia tree that I noticed in the last couple weeks has had a lot of flies and bees around the leaves of it. And yesterday I looked at it really close, and all of the stems and the branches have these little white, like, cocoon-type things on them. It's just covered. And I'm wondering what I can do to save the magnolia bush with some kind of a spray, a fungicide or something. Do you have any idea what that is?
That actually sounds not like a fungal issue. It sounds like you probably have scale on your magnolia. Magnolia scale is... can be really problematic. It can actually kill magnolias depending on how healthy they were or how established they were before they got infected. There are some systemics that you can use that means that the plant will take up the herbicide, and then when the scale insects, they have a piercing, sucking mouth part, they'll go in and feed on it, and it will kill them. The reason you're seeing the flies and wasps are because the scale will emit kind of this honeydew onto the leaves, and then the bees and wasps will actually consume that honeydew. You might also see some black sooty mold develop on those leaves or underneath your magnolia. Those are really good indications you have scale. We do have information about scale on our website on extension.umn.edu. So if you want to see some photos to confirm that that's what it is, I would definitely check it out.
Thank you very much for the call. Laura, did you just say piercing, sucking mouth part?
I did. I'm not an entomologist, but that is one of the phrases I definitely is ingrained in my mind, is that mouth part.
It sounds like a metal band.
Oh, yes, it does, Candace. Our resident rocker is Candace. Another caller on the line, Candace. Who do we have?
Okay, Carletta from St. Paul.
Hi, Carletta. Go ahead. What's your question for Laura?
Hi, Laura. I have a lot of sedum. And on some of them, the ones that have the purplish leaves. I don't know the name of it. It's got a they've got a fungus, all of them. But they're right next to some Autumn Joy, and they don't have a fungus.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a mold, maybe more of it, which is a fungus, I guess.
Yeah, so that can happen. Sometimes we have cultivars that are resistant to certain plant diseases. And so you might be seeing that the Autumn Joy is resistant to whatever that disease issue that you're seeing on the other sedum plant. So if it looks like that the sedum that's infected is really in decline, you can. I would recommend just removing those stems, you know, go out there with pruners and cut those down. And then you can put those in your yard waste bin if you have yard waste collection that goes to a commercial facility. But I would not put the disease material in your home compost because typically it's not going to get hot enough to kill whatever that disease is.
Great. Thank you for the call, Carletta. It is 823 on WCCO. We're taking your calls and questions for Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension. And Laura, I want to blow through some of these texts because they are flooding in this morning. So let's do kind of a rapid fire quick question and answer, if you don't mind. First of all, back to that question I alluded to earlier. What is Japanese knotweed? And then I guess, how do we control it?
Yeah, so Japanese knotweed was brought in. There were a couple of cultivars that were brought in because they are beautiful, beautiful plants, but they spread quite aggressively. Not only do they have underground stems called rhizomes that will spread and kind of form a thicket, they also produce seeds pretty prolifically, and they cross with other knotweeds that aren't as problematic. So we have a lot of hybrids out there. And so control is a lot of hand removal. Right now is the perfect time to go in, dig up, and you need to get underground. It's kind of like anything that we know have rhizomes, we really got to dig. And then you're going to probably dig again in September if you see any regrowth. There are also some different herbicides that you can use, and that best time to do that is in August into early September for any of the ones that translocate that herbicide around. But remember, everyone, if I say anything about herbicides, the label is the law. Make sure you're reading the label and following the instructions.
Great. Good advice. Another texter, ferns have taken over one of my gardens. How do I stop the spread and get rid of some of the plants other than trying to dig them out?
Oh, that was going to be my answer
digging.
For you, was digging.
Yeah.
Digging is the best thing you can do. They have a really great crown and root system. And if you break any of that main crown, that's where all the fronds, the leaves are coming out of, they'll just spread, continue to spread. So digging is actually the most effective way, unfortunately, to remove those.
Maybe not when it's this hot.
Yeah.
They can tolerate them a little longer, huh?
Yeah. That's for human health more than the plants.
Yeah, true. All right. Another texter, we have had an influx of millipedes on our driveway in the mornings. What is going on? I don't like millipedes. I found one. Okay, inside baseball here. It is not the easiest for me to sleep on Friday nights when I know I have this show at 6 a.m. Saturday morning. I'm still getting used to it. I'm still getting comfortable with this. It's just a little bit of anxiousness. I wouldn't even call it anxiety, but anxiousness. Yesterday, in the morning, when I turned on the bedroom light, I saw a millipede scamper across the bedroom floor. You think that's not on my mind when I'm trying to sleep last night? So I had the broom out last night. I'm like trying to, if he is still in the bedroom, I'm trying to get him to come out from under the dresser. I'm raising the rug. It's just like I needed to clear my mind that this millipede was not still in the bedroom. I hate them. I know they're probably harmless. But what's going on for this person who is having an influx of millipedes on their driveway, do you think?
Yeah. Well, there are different ones. There's millipedes and centipedes, and they're different.
Ugh.
Most of the time what we see indoors
leg count.
Oh my gosh, my brain just blanked. They're the ones with the really long legs, but they're really great. They eat a whole bunch of other insects.
Well,
usually they're in a basement or somewhere.
I'll learn to appreciate them.
But yeah, I'm not an entomologist. I wish I could answer that. Why are we having more insects? I know I've had quite a few people asking about ants, and honestly,
yeah.
I'm not versed very well.
But the Extension website would probably have some of that information, right?
Yeah, definitely more on, I'm pretty sure we have a pretty good page on ants. But because outdoors, centipedes and millipedes aren't really an issue, it's not a problem pest most of the time. Yeah, we don't have super detailed information there.
Okay. Keep your questions coming for Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension, 651-461-9226. It is 827 on CCO. Lots of questions on the text line coming up, including how to keep those tomatoes producing in this hot weather. That's next on CCO. Hey, good morning. It's 832 on WCCO. I'm Laura Oakes. Joined by another Laura, Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension. She's here with us in the studio today for the first time. Love having you here. It's always nice to put a name with the face, face with the name. And I just think it's a better conversation when people are in person. So thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's get back to that tomato and heat question. What can we do to help tomatoes continue producing in this hot weather, Laura?
Yeah, so what actually ends up happening typically when the temperatures are above 75, actually, which doesn't seem too hot, it can start impacting the tomato flowers. And so when temperatures are too hot, particularly at night, those flowers will actually abort or fall off just from excess heat. Now, two of my amazing colleagues, different extension educators, they wrote a whole webpage on how excessive heat affects the vegetable garden.
Perfect.
And that's on our website, extension.umn.edu. And you can read all about all the reasons your tomatoes might not be producing. But really, there's not much we can do. You can try to put up like an artificial shade for the afternoon heat. Really just let them have a break for a minute and then they'll start producing more flowers.
Okay. They just need a little rest like the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Couple of callers on the line. Candace, who do we have?
Catherine from Blaine.
Excellent. Hi, Catherine. Good morning. What's your question for Laura?
Good morning, Laura and Laura. Mm-hmm. I have a question about, I have a sweet potato that I'm starting to get a sweet potato vine on it. Can I plant that?
Yeah. So the sweet potatoes that we purchase in the store, most of them are grown a little further south, southern Iowa and further south typically. And they need a really, really long growing season in order to actually form more of those sweet potato that we actually harvest. So, you can plant it, but just know you're probably not going to get more edible sweet potatoes from that. And that what we actually call that little growth, those stems coming out of sweet potato, they're called slips. Which is kind of fun.
That is fun. Another caller on the line, Candace. Who do we have?
Julie from St. Louis Park.
Good morning, Julie. What's your question for Laura?
Yes, this spring I received an amarillo. I think that's what you call it. But it's one big bulb, and then it was covered with wax or something like that. And then it blooms. And it bloomed three times, one after another. And now I don't know what to do with it. I mean, do you take the wax off and then plant it?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Thanks, Julie.
So amaryllis are one of the most popular, like, holiday gifted plants in the wintertime. And in the last decade or so, the ones that are in the waxed bulbs have been really popular. You can actually gently remove that wax, take a sharp knife and just lightly score the outside. You can peel that wax off and then you can pot up that amaryllis into, you don't need too big of a pot actually. They don't have a huge root system. So pick a pot that's about 2 inches wider than the bulb itself. And then you're actually only going to bury it about a third of the way to maybe a halfway. But I always like to go a little shallower. So you're not actually going to bury the whole bulb underneath that potting mix. And then you can keep it well watered. It'll actually push out these huge, beautiful paddle-like leaves. And then if you want more information to force them to make them flower again, we have a whole webpage all on amaryllis and how to force them. We also have a hort short that Julie, another person who comes on this show, created. So if you want a 3-minute video on exactly how to remove the wax, pot it up, and plant the bulb, we do have that on our YouTube channel.
Love it. And again, the extension website is extension.umn.edu. I love how you guys nerd out with this stuff and you make videos and there's you were telling me how many different web pages on that website?
Yeah, there's over 1,000
That's
what we've been
amazing.
told. But yeah, there's all different things you can learn and find out. If you want to get deep into farming, we have that stuff too.
Yep, and it's part of your job to update those pages, I understand, huh?
Yes, yes.
That's a lot of work.
It's absolutely. It takes a lot of time, but it's worth it when people can use the information.
Yeah, very good. We are with Laura Irish Hansen from the University of Minnesota Extension, taking your calls, taking your texts about your flowers, your gardens, your lawn, your bugs, your trees. Laura knows it all. Let's get back to the text line here, Laura. We'll kind of run through these and get as many in as we possibly can. Let's see. My question is using old coffee grounds in the compost. Is it good for plants, and which plants hate them? My plants are mainly perennials.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to actually answer this. And there's been research done at other universities in the U.S. about coffee additions into compost and the impacts on plants. Now, coffee has actually quite a few different properties depending on where it was originally grown, how it was roasted, how it was brewed. What's the actual size of the coffee grounds? So there's a lot of factors that go into it. But for the most part, for most of the plants that we're looking at in Minnesota, particularly perennials, if you're adding some coffee into your larger compost piles and it's truly getting composted and heated up, it shouldn't be too problematic. Now, if you have super sandy soils like I do, I try not to add too much coffee because it doesn't break down very fast. And I already have good drainage, so I don't necessarily want more drainage when I'm adding compost to my garden.
Gotcha. So if you are a person who grinds your own coffee beans and you're thinking ahead of possibly using these in the compost, how fine of a grind would you go for?
It depends. So my husband and I make French presses, so it's larger
too.
Pieces than, someone who uses a drip brew. And so just knowing that it's going to take longer for those larger pieces to break down is okay. But I would not put more than 5 to 10% of that compost, if you look at the size of the compost, the volume, I would not add more than 5 to 10% volume of coffee into it.
A little goes a long way.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Candace, looks like we have another caller on the line.
Judy.
All right. Good morning, Judy. What's your question for Laura?
Oh, hi, Laura and Laura.
Hello.
I have a trumpet honeysuckle I put in last year. It gets a good sun. I haven't gotten flowers. I put on this Mighty Bloom, which has very low nitrogen and phosphate and higher phosphate and then some potash. I got that from Bachman's. Now, I went online, and I'm sad to see that they may not bloom for a few years. Is that true?
Yep, that is absolutely true. It can take them a little bit of time to get established. So don't give up on it yet. If the leaves look good, if the new stem and growth looks good, you can just keep doing what you're doing. I also wouldn't over-fertilize with that phosphorus, particularly when it's not actually forming flower buds, because that phosphorus can easily move off with runoff and go into our waterways. So I would just maybe back off if you've been fertilizing quite often with that, and this year while it doesn't have flowers.
Great. Thanks for the call, Judy. Back to the text line, Laura. I have several 10-year-old Taunton ewes that have grown exponentially this summer, exceeding their spaces. Is it too late to trim these beauties? They are, sounds like, 6 to 8 inches. Or maybe they want to trim them 6 to 8 inches.
Yeah, hopefully okay. They want to trim them 6 to 8 mm-hmm. inches, because if they're only 6 to 8 inches, that's, that'd be pretty little to be.
That's not exponential.
Unless you're doing a bonsai or something. So you can trim them. I would kind of hold off. Don't do it this weekend. In most of the state, it's going to be really, really warm. That'll stress the plants out. Wait till the temperatures get a little bit cooler, just because you don't want to stress them. But most of those plants, most of the ewes, are going to be super forgiving. We do have a webpage on pruning evergreens. So if you want more information about different types of evergreen pruning, check that out.
Excellent. Another caller on the line, Candace. Who do we have?
Dennis from Hastings.
Good morning, Dennis. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank
Excellent.
You.
What is your question for Laura?
Well, I have green peppers in the garden. We do every year. And this year, I was surrounding them with straw to keep the weeds down. And now they're not doing very well.
Yeah. So I'm curious how deep that straw is, how close it is to the stem of that plant. So whenever we're using straw underneath, we want to make sure it's not a super, super thick pile. So try to keep it at 3 inches depth. That is ideal for using the any type of organic mulch or most organic mulches. It could also be have you been fertilizing the same? I'm curious about soil moisture. The peppers also, just like the tomatoes from an earlier question, their flowers also abort when when air temperatures are warmer. And so that might be another thing you're seeing this year.
Perfect. Back to the text line. The lilacs along our church parking lot have become overgrown and need to be trimmed. Is August okay, or would fall be better for that?
Neither.
Ooh, okay. What do we do with lilacs?
So, well, I guess it depends on your goals and objectives. So, any of our plants that are flowering in the spring, they're forming those flower buds right now. So, for our lilacs to flower next spring, they're putting on those reproductive, those flowering buds this growing season, so this summer. So when we prune in the summer and fall and even winter, we're actually removing next year's flower buds. So if you still want that hedge to flower, you actually are going to want to wait and prune within 2 weeks of them being done flowering next spring. That's the best time to be pruning any of our spring flowering shrubs or trees. So hold off. If you don't really care, if you're like, hey, these are overgrown, I just want to take a third of them out, you can definitely do that. Just know that you won't, you know, when you remove those stems, they won't flower.
Gotcha.
That is the best thing to do, Dillo. First year, take a third of the largest stems out. The following year, take half of what's remaining of the large stems out. And then in that third final year, you can remove the last of the large stems. That means that you have blooms over 3 years, because it takes lilacs 3 years to be able to form a flower bud.
That's so hard that you're telling people and me to chop out so much of it in those early years when you're so excited to finally have a lilac shrub.
And that's really only for big, established, overgrown.
I
mean, you can still do that with smaller lilacs, but I wouldn't.
Gotcha. All right, back to the phones. Candace, who do we have?
Tom from River Falls.
Good morning, Tom. What's your question?
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I decided at the age of 74 that I was going to start to grow tomatoes this year. I have 5 tomato plants, and they are in 5-gallon pots. I guess my question is twofold. The first question is how do I know when to water these plants? I've heard some people say, go by the leaves. If leaves on the top of the plant are brown, add water. If the leaves on the bottom of the plant are yellow, you've watered too much. And my second question is how often should I fertilize these plants, and should I fertilize them in this hot weather that's coming up?
I am so excited that you've started growing tomatoes. It's just really satisfying and fun. 5-gallon containers are great for tomatoes, particularly our indeterminate tomatoes, those ones that keep growing after they push out some flower buds. For your first question about watering, neither of those things are true or a good way to actually gauge when tomatoes need to be watered, because once they're already to that stressed point, it is actually very bad for fruit development, and it can actually cause those flowers to fall off. It can also cause the fruit to end up getting something called blossom end rot. That's when they get that like kind of brown hard pan on the bottom, and that generally isn't because of a lack of calcium in the potting mix or soil. It's usually from inconsistent watering. So once tomatoes start flowering, that soil, that potting mix needs to be consistently moist so you can have really nice fruit. So the best thing to actually do is take your finger and stick it down into the soil. And if it is dry about an inch down, then you need to water. So don't rely on the leaves wilting. And particularly in the heat, most plants are actually naturally going to wilt over the day. And that's to lessen the amount of sunlight that actually hits the leaves. And then overnight, they usually bounce back up. So looking for wilting leaves isn't ideal. For fertilizing, we actually recommend to pull back on fertilizing after the plants have started forming fruit. Just because most fertilizers have a lot of nitrogen, and nitrogen is going to increase leafy growth and not help with fruit formation. So fertilizing earlier in the season can be helpful.
Great. Good information. And thank you for the call, Tom. It is 8:47 on CCO. We have many, many more questions to get to on the text line. We're still taking your calls as well. 651-461-9226. Back in a moment on CCO. And we are back. It's 8:48 on WCCO. You're listening to Smart Gardens. My name is Laura Oakes, and we are joined by another Laura who is much more knowledgeable than I am on the plants and flowers and everything that you good people are calling and texting about. Laura Irish Hansen from University of Minnesota Extension. Back to the text line, Laura. We have a lot to get through here, so let's just do a little bit of rapid fire. I have a black-eyed Susan that the leaves, once they get established, always seem to turn dry and black. It still flowers, but the leaves look absolutely awful. Any ideas of what to do with that?
Yeah, it could be a few different things. It could be just they can be stressed out from water stress, heat damage. I doubt it is a fertilization issue, although it could be. So you could get your soil tested and send that into the University of Minnesota Soil Clinic. There are a few different diseases that impact them as well. But if it's flowering and looks okay, I recommend planting some things in front of it that will kind of hide those brown leaves.
All right. A large plant has shown up in my native garden called common mullein. Mullein? It has a large flower stem. I see that it can be invasive. Is it best to dig it out before it blooms, or can I wait to see the bloom before I do that? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so mullein is gorgeous, really, really soft, fuzzy leaves. But maybe don't rub it all over your face, because I don't know if it's... actually would be good for you to do that. But anyways, yeah, beautiful blooms. It does seed, so that's how you're getting it into your garden. They have a pretty extensive taproot, if that's what my memory serves for that one.
So what's a taproot?
It's like a big, strong central root that anchors and goes really deep in the ground, kind of like a dandelion. Dandelions have a strong taproot.
Like the main artery.
Bigger plant.
Okay.
And so you're going to want to dig it, so take a sharp shovel and spade, come out far away from like the main base, so maybe like 5 or 6 inches, and dig and try to lift it. It'll be much easier if the soil is moist, which unfortunately a lot of places right now don't have very moist soil. So actually watering before you dig it out can be helpful. You can let it flower just to see what the flowers look like. They're beautiful and yellow, but try not to let it seed.
Good. Are ground up eggshells good for both indoor and outdoor plants?
There's some fun misinformation about using
Now, let's back up for a second, because we were just talking about so many myths about things that work, things that don't work. Try this. And you were just saying that we could do a whole show on just debunking the myths that people hear about what they should do about their plants and their soil and all of that. And is this one of them having to do with eggshells?
Yes. And okay. It's usually the way people talk about it. Usually people use eggshells to increase the amount of calcium that the plants are going to get. But even using like a spice grinder or an old coffee grinder to get a really fine powder, it's going to take a long time for that calcium from those eggshells to actually become available to the plants in the soil. So the eggshells aren't really going to help with that, particularly if you're just crushing them with your hands. It can help with drainage if you need to increase drainage. That sharpness from the crushed eggshells can help reduce some type of insect movement, but it's not a guarantee. So the other issue is don't use unwashed eggshells.
Ooh.
You want to wash them, particularly if you're putting them outside, because fun critters and rodents will start enjoying your garden and compost pile. So definitely make sure you rinse a bit before you use them.
All righty. What is a good fertilizer for tomatoes? Also, how do I tell when my watermelon is ready to pick?
Okay. So the first one, fertilizer for tomatoes, you can generally just use a standard fertilizer that you'll find at the garden center. There are some that have been particularly marketed for like tomatoes or a vegetable garden. And generally those for the fruiting have more phosphorus than they do than most common plant fertilizers. So you can take a look at that. Phosphorus is the second number, by the way, when you're looking at those fertilizer bags. There's usually three numbers there. The other one for watermelons, I went to school at Iowa State, and I had some friends who came from Muscatine, Iowa, which is like the melon part of the state.
Ooh.
It's really sandy. And anyway, and so I tried to learn their tricks, and it is this sound when you take your knuckle and tap it. And if you have a bunch of watermelons, just start being a little weird and go take your knuckle and just kind of wrap onto the fruit. And if it sounds hollow, if it sounds too like dense, you know it's either underripe or too ripe.
Hollow is underripe?
or it's way over. It's fascinating. It depends on how much water they've had, what type of melon it is. You can also look at the tendrils. So where that fruit attaches to the main vine, there is a tendril. I don't typically have success waiting for that to turn kind of like a brownish color, but most people have success doing that. There's also the idea of the yellowing color from where it's been sitting on the ground. But again, some different cultivars don't get to that same hue or same depth of that kind of that yellow color. So I wish I had a good answer for you, but there are fun videos of people knocking or tapping melons, and I recommend just checking those
out. I like
out.
A little watermelon symphony. I like that. Yeah. I like that. Okay, back to the text line. Let's see. Some of these are very long, and I can't read the big long ones, you guys. It's better to call, okay? Back to the lilacs. My lilac tree bloomed in the spring, just bloomed again, and last year it also bloomed for the second time in late August. Can they prune now, or are you saying still wait until spring?
Yeah, so when lilacs are reblooming, there's a couple of different things. There's actually three different things that could be going on. But most commonly, there's actually research going on at the university on lilacs. And so I've talked to the researchers doing lilac research. And the most common thing is stress. And those are the plants that aren't getting watered during the summer, during the dry periods, and particularly when we're seeing old established hedges. And most of the time, we're seeing less than 10% of bloom on for the fall. So that still means you have about 90% for next spring. So we don't want to prune because we can then remove the vast majority of the blooms for next spring. So reblooming is probably due to stress. There's some other fun random things it could be, but it's less likely.
Funny that they rebloom in stressful conditions.
Yeah. Or you might have a cultivar called Bloomerang.
Ooh.
That purposefully blooms twice a year.
I like that. A Bloomerang.
Yeah.
Alrighty, another texter. I have a 30-year-old rhododendron that seems to be dying. How long do they usually live, and is there anything I can do?
Yeah, so rhododendrons, I'm wondering if it's an azalea or a true rhododendron, if it's the evergreen. So azaleas are deciduous, and the true rhododendrons are evergreen. That means they keep their leaves over winter. Further south, I know for sure they can live for a very, very, very long time. I wish my really good friend, who's actually the azalea breeder now at the university, was on the line, because he would have a good answer for you.
Wow. Okay. Well, more information, I would assume, on the website, extension.umn.edu, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We only have a little bit of time left, Laura, about a minute, so why don't we get your best tips for surviving the heat and what we should or should not be doing with our flowers or vegetable gardens?
Yeah, so okay. Get out and water early in the morning. You know, before 10 o'clock is ideal. Make sure you're watering the soil, not the leaves of your plants. If you can't get out in the morning, wait until 6, 7, 8 o'clock before you water in the evening. That's mostly because when we water in the middle of the day with that intense sunlight, we actually lose a lot of moisture to evaporation rather than that getting to the plants. Things for you, same goes for you. You know, it's better for you to be out on those cool fringes. And I just want to plug, don't mow.
That's right.
It's too
yes.
hot.
What happens to our grass when we mow in this heat?
It can really stress it out. Absolutely. So if you can avoid mowing until we get some more cooler days back below 90 as a minimum is ideal. And don't fertilize your cool season grasses. Not worth it right now. They're not growing.
And it's okay. We can all deal with a little brown grass for a while if we need to. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Thanks for coming in, Laura. We appreciate all of your great information and smarts. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you for all of your texts and emails. This has been great. What a great hour. I learned a lot today, especially about tomatoes and about what to do and not do when it is this hot. Extreme heat warning going into effect at noon, about 3 hours from now. Get your stuff done now. Now's the time, because it's going to be a good day to stay inside and keep it cool today. Thanks for joining Smart Gardens. We have the Home Improvement Show with Andy Lindis next, following ABC News at the top of the hour and Al's Local News. Stay with us.